Hello, and thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Into the Killing. If you decided to jump in at episode 53, we love your bravado, and thanks for checking us out. The good news is that most episodes, including this one, are self-contained stories, so you don't have to listen to earlier episodes for this one to make sense. But that being said, we would love it if you went back and checked out the older episodes. Of course, thank you so much if you've been listening all along. For this episode, we're traveling back over four decades to March 1980. It was an interesting time in Canadian politics. Well, as interesting as something like Canadian politics can get. Pierre Elliott Trudeau first became Prime Minister in April 1968. He held the office until his party, the Liberal Party of Canada, lost the election in May 1979. Joe Clark of the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada then became Prime Minister. Pierre Trudeau retired after the defeat. But when the first budget was presented by the Progressive Conservatives, a motion of non-confidence was passed. The problem was that they wanted to make an 18-cent per gallon tax on gas, and this was extremely unpopular. The motion led to another election in February 1980. Pierre Trudeau was asked to become the party leader again, and he agreed. Pierre and the Liberal Party won. He resumed office on March 3rd, less than a year after losing the election. Pierre Trudeau is the father of Canada's current Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. The same month that Pierre Elliott Trudeau returned to office, the first rock and roll festival was held in the Soviet Union. It is considered an important milestone in Soviet/Russian rock music. At the box office, the number one movie was the Bob Fosse-directed musical All That Jazz. The number one song in the United States was Crazy Little Thing Called Love by the incomparable Queen. In March 1980, 18-year-old Marilyn McIntyre lived with her husband, 23-year-old Lane, and their 3-month-old son, Christopher. They lived in an apartment in Columbus, Wisconsin. Columbus is a small city in south-central Wisconsin. It's about 28 miles northeast of Madison. In 1980, it had a population of about 4,000 people. If you saw the 2009 Michael Mann-directed movie, Public Enemies, starring Johnny Depp, you got a few glimpses of Columbus because several scenes were shot there. Lane and Marilyn had been married for a little over a year. Marilyn had a difficult life growing up. When she was just 5, her mother was killed in a car accident. Her father remarried, and her stepmother was horribly abusive, both mentally and physically. The abuse was so bad that she and her siblings were placed in foster care. But her foster family wasn't much better. Her foster father was also abusive. Despite her hard life, Marilyn was kind and generous. She also loved people. When she was 16, she met 21-year-old Lane McIntyre. According to people who knew them, it was love at first sight. They were married in January 1979 when Marilyn was 17. In December 1979, Marilyn gave birth to a son, Christopher. Lane worked at a factory in Columbus that made paper products. On the night of March 10, 1985, Lane said that he and Marilyn did laundry. He then left for work at 10:45 p.m. for the factory's third shift. They lived a little more than half a mile from the factory. At 7 a.m., Lane finished his shift and drove home. He said that when he got into their apartment, he found his wife dead. A paring knife was sticking out of her chest and her head had been mutilated. Lane immediately checked on their 3-month-old son, Christopher. He was unharmed in his crib. Lane then called his parents, and they were the ones who called 911. The medical examiner learned that the knife in Marilyn's chest was not the cause of death. She may have even been stabbed post-mortem. She had been struck repeatedly in the head. It left her with a fractured skull. She had also been strangled. The police talked to the neighbors. They said that the couple often got into loud arguments. This included the night of the murder. Lane told the police that they were just boisterous people. One of the neighbors remembered their dog barking at 3:15 a.m. The neighbor thought it was strange because she had never heard the dog bark like that. The medical examiner placed Marilyn's death at around 3:30 a.m. So the police believe that the murder happened sometime between 3:15 and 3:30 a.m. The police noted that a lot of rage went into the killing. The police looked around and found nothing stolen. There were no signs of a break-in or forced entry. This suggested that Marilyn knew her killer. Also, the evidence suggested the murder happened in the middle of the night. A new mother wouldn't put her child at risk by letting a stranger into her home at around 3 in the morning. The brutality of the murder also suggested it was personal. The police learned that just 3 days before Marilyn was murdered, Lane had taken out a life insurance policy on Marilyn. He would pay out $10,000 if she died. In 2022, that's about $35,000. Romantic partners, or former romantic partners, are almost always the lead suspects in the murder of adults, and it was no different in this case. The overkill, no forced entry or break-in, and the life insurance policy just made Lane look more suspicious. Lane swore he was innocent. He said he loved his wife deeply and he had no reason to kill her. He also had an alibi. He was at work when she was killed and his time card backed that up. But the problem was with his alibi. Lane often worked alone and he had breaks throughout the night. Since he only lived a couple minutes from the factory, he could have slipped out, killed his wife, and made it back to the factory without anyone noticing. But the police had no physical evidence that connected him to the murder. It wasn't long before the case went cold. Many people thought it was an utterly tragic murder. Marilyn had such a hard life growing up, but she was happy being married and being a mother, so it seemed like she would have a happy adulthood. She was really murdered at just the age of 18. It seemed like she was robbed of the better years of her life. Everyone in Marilyn's family felt like they had been robbed of her. They pointed out that Christopher never got to call her mother and he has no memories of her. Within months of the murder, Lane remarried. The woman he remarried raised Christopher as her son. When Christopher was 9 or 10 years old, Lane told him the truth about his biological mother. Christopher said he was angry and confused when he learned the truth. Marilyn had an identical twin sister, Carolyn, and she was devastated by the loss. Less than a year after the murder, Carolyn gave birth to a daughter, Tara. Tara said her first memories were seeing her mother crying on the phone, talking about her murdered twin sister. Carolyn said she turned to alcohol to help her cope. But the alcohol destroyed her life. She said she wasn't there for her children. She also had 2 failed marriages. Lane also went through 2 failed marriages. The rumors and suspicion never left Lane. Many people in the small town thought he was the killer. One of those people was Marilyn's sister, Brenda. She thought it was appalling that Lane got married just months after Marilyn was murdered. Brenda didn't like Lane before he married Marilyn, and she didn't approve of the relationship. Brenda firmly believed that Lane had killed her sister. Lane knew he could have moved away from Columbus, but he knew he was innocent, and he felt that innocent people do not run away. The problem was that the rumors reached Christopher. Lane and Christopher's relationship deteriorated. Christopher moved out of Lane's home when he was just 15. Eventually, Lane and Christopher became estranged. Every few years, someone from Marilyn's family would call the Columbus police and ask them to reopen the case. but no progress was ever made on the case. Then in 2007, Marilyn's niece, Tara, who was born a year after the murder, decided to contact the police. It had been 27 years since the murder, and a lot had changed. In 1980, the president was Democrat Jimmy Carter, and in 2007, it was Republican George W. Bush. The Sony Walkman was just a year old in 1980. In 2007, the sixth generation of iPod was released. The biggest movie of 1980 was Star Wars Episode V, The Empire Strikes Back. In 2007, it was the atrocious Spider-Man 3, starring Tobey Maguire. 1980's biggest song was Call Me by Blondie, led by one of the queens of rock, Debbie Harry. In 2007, it was Irreplaceable by Queen Bey, Beyonce. When Tara tried to call the Columbus police, she made a mistake that would prove to be fateful. Columbus is mostly in Columbia County, and parts are in Dodge County. Tara accidentally contacted the Columbia County Sheriff's Department, not the Columbus Police Department. Tara spoke with Detective Lieutenant Wayne Smith, who had never heard of the case. He was completely unaware that there was an unsolved murder in the county. After talking to Tara, he read over the case. He then decided to reopen the investigation. Lieutenant Smith learned that Lane McIntyre was not the only suspect in the case. When Lane was questioned, he was asked if anyone he knew could have killed his wife. He said that his friend, Curtis Forbes, could have been the one who killed Marilyn. Lane and Curtis had known each other since grade school. In grade school, they didn't like each other. Lane called them mortal enemies. They would physically fight each other. But in high school, they became friends. At the time of the murder, Lane considered Curtis to be one of his best friends. However, he suspected that Curtis had a bit of a crush on Marilyn. Lane said that he and Marilyn would hang out with Curtis and his fiancée, 22-year-old Debbie Adelson. It turned out that Curtis was abusive with Debbie, and she told Marilyn about the abuse. Marilyn then convinced Debbie to break it off with Curtis. So when Marilyn was murdered, Debbie and Curtis were separated. The police interviewed Curtis, and he didn't have a great alibi. He said on the night of the murder, he was at a bar until about 1 a.m. Afterward, he went over to the home of Lori Beatty. He said he stayed there for a bit, and they left. He said that he got to the home where Debbie lived with her parents at about 2 or 2:30 a.m. and stayed there the rest of the night. The police checked out the details of his confession. Lori Beatty confirmed that Curtis showed up at her home. Beatty believed that Curtis had wanted to sleep with her, but her boyfriend was over. Curtis stayed for a few minutes. He said he would get some beer and come back, but he never returned. The police then talked to Debbie Allison and her parents. They said that Curtis did come by their home that morning, but it was 4 o'clock when he got there. That left 2 hours unaccounted for. During that time, Marilyn McIntyre was murdered. The day after the police questioned Curtis Forbes, he left town. He wrote letters to both Debbie and Lane. In both letters, he said he couldn't go to jail for something he didn't do. In the letter to Debbie, he wrote that there was too much circumstantial evidence. Curtis stayed away for about 2 months, and then he returned to Columbus. 5 months later, he married Debbie Adelson. Lieutenant Smith decided to interview some key witnesses in the case. Lane's story was the same. He said he left for work at 10:45 p.m. and Marilyn was alive. He found her dead when he got home, and his parents called 911. Lieutenant Smith interviewed Lori Beatty, whom Curtis had visited the night of the murder after he finished drinking at the bar. Once again, she said that Curtis came over to her place while he stayed for a few minutes. But this time, she had new detail about that night. Lori said that 2 weeks after the murder, Debbie had told her that Curtis showed up at her house that night and asked her to take care of his clothes. His shirt had bloodstains on it. Lori was asked why she didn't tell the police about the bloodstained shirt when she was initially interviewed. She assumed that Debbie had said something about it. Lieutenant Smith asked some other people, and they had heard that Debbie's mother had washed some blood out of Curtis's clothes. Lieutenant Smith couldn't question Debbie's parents about the murder because, by 2007, they had both passed away. Debbie was still alive, and she was still married to Curtis. They lived in Randolph, Wisconsin, a village 50 miles north of Columbus. Lieutenant Smith questioned Debbie. She said she was never really close with Lori Beatty and never told her that Curtis showed up with blood on his shirt. Debbie also said she must have been mistaken when she told the police it was 4 o'clock when Curtis showed up. She said she must have read the clock wrong. She initially thought it was 10 after 4, but it was really 20 after 2 when he came over. She said she just got the hands on the clock mixed up. She also denied that Curtis was abusive. In 1980, she told the police that Curtis had hit her once. In 2007, she claimed that she had never told Marilyn that Curtis was hitting her. She also said she never left Curtis. Lieutenant Stevens had the evidence sent to the crime lab. Lane voluntarily gave a sample of his DNA. In evidence were hair samples that Curtis gave in 1980. The only DNA evidence was a bloodstain found in the bathroom sink. The crime lab determined it was Marilyn's blood mixed with someone else's blood. The testing excluded one of the men. That was Marilyn's husband, Lane McIntyre. It was 100% not his DNA. The testing did not exclude Curtis Forbes as the contributor, but the testing was not conclusive. The DNA could have also come from one out of every 98 people. So even in a town of 4,000 people, like Columbus, the DNA could have come from 39 other people. Nevertheless, it did prove that Lane did not murder his wife. In March 2008, the police had Marilyn's body exhumed. They were hoping to find more DNA evidence under her fingernails. Unfortunately, due to the state of decomposition, no new evidence was found. But the Sheriff's Department did not make this information public. Besides collecting DNA evidence, the Sheriff's Department had a second reason for exhuming the body. They wanted to see if it would rattle their suspect. It apparently worked. They had Curtis under surveillance, and he did some unusual things. He contacted a carpenter's union in Hawaii. He also purchased a rubber raft. It turned out that Curtis was planning on faking his own death. He was going to take a boat out onto Lake Michigan and then sink it. Then he'd take the raft to shore. When his body wasn't found, people would just assume he had drowned and his body was somewhere in Lake Michigan. Meanwhile, he'd be living in Hawaii. Lieutenant Smith spent 2 years investigating Marilyn's murder. He had interviewed 60 people. In spring 2009, he finally decided it was time to interview the prime suspect in the case, Curtis Forbes. On March 24, 2009, Curtis, who was now 51 years old, was brought to the police station. He was confronted and told that his blood had been found mixed with Marilyn's blood. Curtis said he didn't know how that was possible. While Curtis was being questioned, two other detectives questioned his wife, Debbie. After several hours, she admitted that there was blood on Curtis's shirt when he arrived at her house on the night of the murder. Curtis Forbes was arrested that night for the murder of Marilyn McIntyre. 2 days later, Curtis called his wife, Debbie, from jail. Here's a recording of the actual phone call.
I have to find out what the facts are first.
The facts are, Deborah, I did not murder Marilyn McIntyre.
Then where did the bloody shirt come from?
I'll explain all that. I did not kill Marilyn.
Well, explain it to me then.
Not on the phone.
As you can hear, he doesn't deny having blood on his shirt when he came over to her home that night. Before the trial, a judge ruled that the DNA evidence would not be allowed to be submitted as evidence. The judge did not think that the results were conclusive enough to be used as evidence. At this point, Marilyn's family members who thought that Lane had killed her had changed their minds. They believed he was completely innocent. Curtis's family, on the other hand, firmly believed that Curtis was innocent. He was being railroaded by the justice system. The trial started on November 9, 2010. There was not a piece of evidence that was considered a metaphorical silver bullet. Instead, the case was entirely circumstantial. Curtis did not have an alibi for the time of the murder. When he was first seen after the murder, he had blood on his shirt. Then they had the phone call where Curtis did deny they had blood on his shirt that night. Over 6 days, 45 witnesses testified. The defense case was simple. Lane McIntyre was the one who killed his wife. He had the means, motive, and opportunity. Neighbors testified that the couple often argued. The defense pointed out that 3 days before Marilyn was murdered, Lane had taken out a life insurance policy on her. Lane also could have left work and murdered her. After 6 days of testimony, the jury retired to deliberate. In just 2.5 hours, they reached a verdict. 30 years after Marilyn McIntyre's murder, Curtis Forbes was found guilty of first-degree murder. In February 2011, 53-year-old Curtis Forbes was given a mandatory life sentence. One question was, why did Curtis murder his friend's wife? Lane believes that he tried to pick up a woman at the bar, but she rejected him. He then tried to hook up with Lori Beatty, but her boyfriend was over. So he decided to see Marilyn because he knew Lane would be at work. Lane believes that Curtis went over there intending to rape her. Unlike many other states, Wisconsin does not have a public database for offenders. It's not known where Curtis is incarcerated or if he's incarcerated at all. He was eligible for parole in June 2020. Debbie divorced Curtis after he was sentenced. After the trial, Lane and his son Christopher decided to repair the relationship. Lane said that Marilyn would want her son and her husband to be best of friends. Lane also told 48 Hours that he was happy the case was closed. He said Marilyn would want us to have closure. There were so many people that loved Marilyn, still do, always will. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Don't forget to check out our new YouTube channel, Paranormally Listed. You can find it at youtube.com/paranormallylisted. Of course, we still have our original true crime channel, Criminally Listed. We have over 325 videos featuring bizarre but true crime stories. You can find it at youtube.com/criminallylisted. Well, that's all for today. Thanks again for listening. Please stay safe and take care of yourself.